and delighted to have the opportunity to rethink John Howard Yoder with you. It's been a long time since I've been wrestling with Yoder, and as I go back to Yoder's work here, it is indeed a sense of wrestling. I'm not always sure what to make of Yoder, where to go with what he says, but I am always convinced it's very rich and fruitful and stimulating stuff. Even if I don't know what to do with it, at least I'm provoked in the right sort of way, it seems to be. Again, for those of you who've been to a session previously, I apologize for rehearsing some stuff, but if you haven't been, then hold good. John Howard Yoder was one of the most prominent theologians and ethicists in America at the time of his death in December. He had just one day past his 70th birthday, born December 29th, 1927. Died this past December 30th. He was at that time teaching theological ethics at the University of Notre Dame, not well known for its Mennonite sensibilities or commitments, but not far from Goshen, and Yoder had made the transition from Goshen, where he'd been previously teaching at the Mennonite Seminary, to Notre Dame. He'd been very influential, primarily, I think probably exclusively teaching doctoral students at Notre Dame. His influence has probably been felt or seen most visibly in American circles, and his influence upon Stanley Hauerwas, who's quite a character, teaches at Duke University, teaches theological ethics, but taught at Notre Dame with John Howard Yoder. Stanley has a completely different personality, completely different tactics, and so undoubtedly was an embarrassment to John Howard Yoder many times, but nevertheless greatly influenced by Yoder. Today's session, our goal is to think about the people of God and what it means to be the church. The title is The Royal Priesthood, or How Can the Church Be the Church? And I'm going to draw from a number of texts of Yoder, but primarily we'll be thinking through what he wrote and said in a little book called Body Politics, the five practices of the Christian community before the watching world. This fits in well, I think, with the general theme of Guide Our Feet and the emphasis upon practices in the book co-edited by Dorothy Bass, Practicing Our Faith. Fits in well with that. And the other reason is, a couple of other reasons, that I checked this out of the library here, and in front cover you see John Howard Yoder's Two Holden Village. The reason he wrote that was because this book originated, or at least part of its genesis, was in a class like this, perhaps even in this room, I don't check to see, here at Holden Village. And the discussions that were the basis for this book are in the tape library, and you can check them out. Just to read to you from his preface, because it is relevant here, in which he expresses special gratitude to various people. He writes, "I owe special gratitude to those in whose company these things were first treated in something like this form." And among those, he mentions, to Ingrid Christensen and Jody Kretzman of Holden Village for the opportunity to review these same materials while renewing our family's bond with the village's unique brand of Lutheranism. So seems relevant to do that here at this time. Yoder, as I've mentioned previously, was here on numerous occasions, 79, 81, 83, and 88, I believe. Well, okay, we start with the royal priesthood. The title of a collection of essays published several years ago, The Royal Priesthood. The subtitle is Essays Ecclesiological and Ecumenical. So it's primarily an academic scholarly work. Essays about the church, what it means to be the church, and essays about how the churches relate to one another, what it means to be the church and what it means to be the church universal, what it means to be Mennonite in relation to Lutherans, in relation to Reform, in relation to Catholic, that collection of essays. One of the things that Yoder increasingly did with his publications, he would draw upon New Testament texts like the royal priesthood, or another one of his books just before this time was The Priestly Kingdom. He's drawing, in this case, upon 1 Peter 2:9, which I don't have memorized, but if you do, then I will have to look it up. I won't have to try to remember where 1 Peter is.
It's in the New Testament.
I got that. I've even narrowed it down.
It's after the Gospels.
I've done the AEIO thing. So
right before 2 Peter.
Do we have consensus that it's after Hebrews?
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're on a roll. 1 Peter 2:9. That was in a second. Now we're there. 1 Peter 2, verse 9. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people, in order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. And then he quotes an Old Testament passage, once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's own people. Why? In order that you may proclaim the mighty acts of Him who called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Well, I thought as a way to open and sort of focus our attention, we might think about the following question. Are there things a church, an institution, a body of people calling themselves a church, are there things a church might be or do which would result in your leaving or deciding not to join that particular body calling itself a church? Can you think of things?
Do you mean denominationally or different?
Either one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, either denominationally or in terms of a specific congregation. Are there things, and I'm not thinking so much of matters of taste here. I mean, example, if it was a style of worship that you thought, well, that's probably good for some people, it's not going to work for me. I'm not thinking of that sort of thing.
Like denying membership on basis of race?
Okay. Yeah. So that would be an example. If it were a congregation that said only people of this race are welcome here, then that would be something that you think would be a good reason for you not to join. Other sorts of things, examples.
Either patriarchal or it doesn't matter whether it's a guy or a gal, but there's one guy in charge instead of a body that's in charge.
Hierarchical. Okay,
there you go. Just hire that out. So,
okay, but it's going to be hard. Well.
Well, I'm Presbyterian.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, okay.
And so, you know, we have a session. And then there's a presbytery.
Yeah. You know, bishops. And
so our pastor, you know, doesn't have full control over what happens at our church. We live in an area where a church like that has got involved in a legal battle regarding misconduct. Mm-hmm. And the way they handle that, you know, was so different than a church that was connected to the bigger picture of the whole denomination, mm-hmm. versus also, you know, he was in charge of that church and it was so inbred mm-hmm. that it wasn't probably dealt with in a proper manner.
Okay. So it's more democratic structure, exactly. Some sort of democratic yeah. structure.
I mean, if the church was inwardly focused only, you know, then I didn't see much evidence of mission type work, some, you know, not only just benevolence dollars, but also some, you know, a sense of servanthood beyond themselves.
Okay, so something you wouldn't be able to tell just by looking at the budget. You'd want to see, right. you know, the budget would indicate something, but you'd want to see more than mm-hmm. the budget.
Okay.
Other sources.
Church that didn't want to grow and change.
Grow
in numbers, not because of numbers' sake, but because of outreach, like she's saying, but also church that was willing to, I hate the word dialogue, but to dialogue about things and to kind of work together and study things, not one that was fixed in its doctrine.
Okay. Is that another way just of saying something that's alive?
That, yes, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Yep.
If a church supported a candidate for office,
okay.
must vote for this party, this, these people yeah. belong to this church.
Right? Okay. What about if not supporting a candidate as such, but particular policies?
Like abortion.
From the pulpit.
Like abortion.
Okay. Would that be a problem?
Sexual marriage. It would be a problem for me if they took a stand on my part.
Okay.
Interesting, because I would often like to see churches take stands that they won't
okay.
stand.
Yeah.
Take.
Yeah.
I did leave a church, and I think that what you're trying to articulate in the way of hierarchy had a lot to do with it. It isn't just that when there's a clergy in charge, but it is just then, I think, when you have that, the community begins to see itself that way. And it's often then the wealthier white males in the community who are at least 50 years old and older. But to people
glad
generally,
you said that, please.
Generally, yeah. People generally tend to assume that they don't have to incorporate all points mm-hmm. of view or be open to it, that they can say, this is how we do things. That in combination with an emphasis on atonement that I think is misplaced.
Okay, what we're doing here, implicitly, if not explicitly, implicitly what we're appealing to is what we take to be marks of the church. That implicitly we're assuming there are certain identifying characteristics, certain norms, certain standards in light of which, if you're going to be the church, you have to have these marks. Without these marks, you cannot be the church. I think that's implicitly what's going on here. Now, let's try to be a bit more explicit about that, and let's look back a little bit on the tradition and draw on it. Once I phrase it in that way, we can do the Luther thing, or we can honor the Presbyterian presence and do the Calvinist thing. In terms of Luther or Calvin's identification of the marks of the church, do you recall what those consist of? What Luther identified as the true marks of the church, without this going on, Luther said, you don't have a church.
The word is preached, and sacraments administered rightly.
Yeah, exactly. Right preaching of the gospel, the word is preached, fidelity to the gospel made present and made known by Jesus Christ, and appropriate administration and regular administration of the sacraments. That's Luther. Calvin, in the Presbyterian tradition, pretty much in sync with that, but adding one element to that. A matter of discipline, or orderly and disciplined church life. Okay. Well, today, what we want to do is spend some time looking at Yoder's five marks or five practices, which Yoder takes to be constitutive of the people of God, constitutive of the church. The Yoder's first response, if we just focus at Luther's two marks to the church, the first thing Yoder draws our attention to, he says, look, if you think of the marks of the church being there in the right preaching and right administration of the sacraments, if you want to know whether you've got a church, whether you're dealing with the church, where do you look? Do you look in the pews around you?
The lives of the people.
Well, not if the marks. If the marks are going to be right preaching and right and regular, you look up here.
Yeah.
Exactly. And now Yoder says, wait a second. There's something strange about this. About saying you've got a church, when really all you're talking about is what the person up in front of the congregation is doing. Isn't that peculiar? If we take the idea of the royal priesthood, if we take seriously the idea of the people of God, isn't there something strange about locating at the one and the same time saying, you are the people of God, the church is the people of God, and then saying, but of course we've got a church present whenever that person up there, whoever he or she is doing that. That's Yoder's first comment. A second thing Yoder brings our attention to is to say, and you know, Luther himself sort of had second thoughts about this, or was troubled about this, or wasn't entirely happy. And let me read a passage from Luther that Yoder quotes. Luther at one point actually proposed that there be three different kinds of church services. And if any of you are clergy, this is quite daunting to think that not only do you have to do one liturgy, you've got to do three. But anyhow, Luther proposed three different types of liturgies. Three different types of divine service. First, he said, there's the Mass in Latin. And Luther was happy enough with that, didn't think he needed to change, abrogate that. The second, it was a good as far as it went. It wasn't all you wanted. You needed other things in addition. The second was the vernacular German Mass and the order of service. And that Mass should be arranged according to the abilities and the understanding of the lay folk, unlearned lay folk. That was to be used in public. And that second, that vernacular German Mass, Luther suggested, should be used in public with, and I quote Luther here, those who do not believe and who are not yet Christians. Right? So you want a service in German vernacular which reaches those who in some sense, don't own the Christian faith in the way you want them to. The third kind of service, Luther says, and this again is to quote from Luther, the third kind of service should be a truly evangelical order and should not be held in a public place for all sorts of people. It's going to be a church service, but it's not open to the general public. Don't post the time on the bulletin board out in front of the church, because you don't want people, you don't know people coming in off the street, because it's not for them as such. Those who want to be Christians, this is who it's for, those who want to be Christians in earnest and who profess the gospel with hand and mouth should sign their names and meet alone to pray, to read, to baptize, to receive the sacrament, and to do other Christian works. According to this order, those who do not lead Christian lives could be known, reproved, corrected, cast out, or excommunicated according to the rule of Christ, which is Matthew 18, verses 15 through 17. Here, one should also solicit benevolent gifts to be willingly given and distributed to the poor, according to St. Paul's example. Here would be no need of much and elaborate singing. That's a sort of peculiar addition, it seems to me. But here one could set up a brief and neat order for baptism and the sacrament and center everything on the word, prayer, and love. Well, the point is, Yoder's point in appealing to that maneuver is to say, even within the Reformation tradition, not just the radical reformers, the Anabaptists, in which Yoder traces his lineage to. Even within the Reformation, Luther was of two minds. The idea that there was something wrong with a church which didn't, in its actions, look like the church. There was some need to have a people of God which would function as a royal priesthood. Yoder's alternative, then, is to propose that what should take place is the church, the real people of God, should be a royal priesthood, a people called to confess that Christ is Lord in word and in deed. That's what the church is to be. The first aspect of that is, then, that here's what's historically true: Christ is Lord. Church had nothing to do with that. This is what God has done in history, in the life, death, and resurrection of Christ. Christ has been made Lord of history, which guarantees that God's will for the world will have its way, that God's desire for shalom, for human flourishing, for human beings at peace within themselves, at peace with God, at peace with the creation, that God will accomplish that. That's the story of history. And no one and nothing can frustrate that goal of God. That's the story of the biblical story, as Yoder reads. Now, that being the case, the reality is there's a sense in which, well, the church isn't essential to what God's going to do in the world or what God has done in the world. God has accomplished it. It's not dependent upon what the church, the people of God, do. God has done it all. Well, but what does that mean for the church? Well, what that means, then, the church is called to be the first fruits of that achievement of God. And to be those who, because God has disclosed to them what God has accomplished, those who confess, who testify, who witness to the reality that is hard to see. To be the first fruits in the sense of living out, exemplifying in their life what that community, what that shalom looks like. And to be witnesses to say, well, all right, you can't see it real well, maybe, but this is what God's way with the world looks like. That's the calling of the church. Well, Yoder thinks that calling is exercised in five practices, five marks. You can find this, Yoder thinks, when you study the early church. These are five practices that the church, if it's going to be the church, will be involved in today. These aren't disciplines. There are other disciplines the church will need to take upon itself, prayer, Bible study. But these are five practices which distinguish, which characterize, which mark something as the church. The first practice we can read about in Matthew 18, verses 15 through 18. And this is what's known as the rule of Christ. If your brother or sister sins, go and reprove that person. When the two of you are alone, if your brother or sister sins, go and reprove that person when the two of you are alone. If he or she listens, you have won your brother or sister. What you bind on earth is bound in heaven. It's the rule of Christ. The first practice, then, that Mark B's on the board. The first practice, Yoder calls the practice of binding and loosing. And there are two aspects of this practice of binding and loosing. One component built into it is a practice of moral discernment. And the other component or aspect of it is forgiveness. So the other says, all right, when you've got a church, what's got to be characterizing the life of that church is this practice of confrontation in order to restore, this practice of forgiving. The church is to be a place of forgivingness, a place of forgiveness. Moral discernment is required, first of all, in this then, that the charge is, if your brother or sister sins, go and reprove that person when the two of you are alone. Right? If your brother or sister sins, well, all right. I mean, we all know our own characters. And we know that there are some peculiarities we have, some things that just bug us, even though they're not really sins. And we get mad at people for these things that really bug us. Well, the same thing could happen with respect to sin, then. If we know ourselves, we get angry at people when they're not really doing something wrong. So it's likely that some things we think will be sinful really aren't sinful. And so what's required, if we're really going to execute this binding and loosing, we're going to have to talk as a community about what things are sinful and what things aren't sinful. We can't avoid that. We can't get around that. We can't have people going off and charging people with sins when all they're really dealing with is their own personal quirks. So the way we get straight about that is being a community in which together we talk and try to discern what genuine things are sinful and what things are not sinful. So the church has got to be a community of moral discernment. Secondly, the church has got to be a community of forgiveness. The whole point of the rule of Christ is to restore people to the fellowship, is to recognize that by our actions, we can do things that prevent fellowship, and that what has to take place, what's needed, is a way of restoring ourselves to that fellowship. That's what the life of the church is to be by. Okay, I think what I'll do is I'll just run through these and then we'll come back and talk about them at a more leisurely place as you wish to. Second practice of the church. Second mark. Disciples break bread together. Now that's sort of the orders. In part, he is acknowledging the sacrament of the Eucharist, but it's also a bit of desacramentalization going on here. For Yoder, his suggestion is the Eucharist, well, the breaking of bread together has to be a regular part of the life of the church, but in some part is primarily economic. What's going on when we break bread together, when we share together, our attention is drawn to those who are needy, who are less fortunate. And so the practice of breaking bread has to be a practice in which we're reminded of the poor, in which we try to redistribute our goods for the sake of those who are poor and those who are needy. Whenever you do this, whenever you break bread in my memory, you are reminded that at the table before you, Christ sits at the head of the table. It is an opportunity to give thanks to God for God's goodness to us and to notice that, well, wait a second, some people aren't at this table. We've got to get them to the table. I don't need as large a helping as this if that's what's required to get that person to the table. So it is a message of economic share.
Are you talking about communion or sharing meals?
Yes. I think that's sort of what's going on, is that insofar as communion distracts us, I mean, it can be a legitimate sign. What we need to be aware of for yogurt, when communion takes place, if we're not literally having a meal, breaking the bread, then that's a sign of what should be going on in the community. It's a transaction between God and the people in which all are invited in to share the bread, to share the meal together. It's to remind us of those who are outside, who are hungry, who are poor, who are needy. So I think there is a sense in which, well, there's a desacramentalization going on here, that what's important about the communion is that it symbolizes, it's a sign for a more significant, more expansive breaking of bread that should be taking place. Third mark, baptism. Let me read 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 14 through 17. For the love of Christ urges us on, because we're convinced that one has died for all, therefore all have died. And he died for all, so that those who live might live no longer for themselves, but for him who died and was raised for them. From now on, therefore, we regard no one from a human point of view. Even though we once knew Christ from a human point of view, we know him no longer in that way. So if anyone is in Christ, there's a new creation. Everything old has passed away. See, everything has become new. Baptism, primarily, the order suggests, is an indication that God has achieved an equality of peoples that doesn't ignore the identity of peoples. What's significant, what's earth-shaking about baptism is that Jew and Gentile are now equals. It's not the case that one is no longer a Jew or one is no longer a Gentile. That's fixed. But what is the case is that an equality has been achieved. In baptism, there is an equality of all persons, of all human beings. Inherited social definitions are not basic to our identity. What's basic to our identity is God's declaration of our status. In baptism, God declares us all as equals.
But he's an Anabaptist, you know, so it's a believer's baptism.
Yeah, quite right. Although, I mean, that's right. The church is the community of believers. At this point, I think his suggestion is that for the original Anabaptist, Yoder argues what was important to them originally wasn't should children be baptized. What was important to them originally was, what sort of community do you have to be to execute the rule of Christ, this process of binding and loosing? And if obviously infants can't execute the binding and loosing process, and if that's the case, if that's a mark and infants can't do it, well, that's got to push you in that direction. So quite right to bring our attention to that. It is a matter of believers' church and believers' baptism. Fourth mark, the multiplicity of ministries. And the relevant passage, although there are a number of passages that speak to this, the multiplicity of ministries, Ephesians 4, verses 11 through 13. The gifts he gave were that some would be apostles, some prophets, some evangelists, some pastors and teachers, to equip the saints for the work of ministry, for building up the body of Christ, until all of us come to the unity of the faith, of the knowledge of the Son of God, to maturity, to the measure of the full status of Christ. Basically, what Yoder suggests here is taking in a very radical way the priesthood of all believers. What the early church believed, Yoder claims, and what the early church practiced was this multiplicity of ministries. Every person who is in Christ has a gift for the service of the church, for the sake of the church executing its identity as first fruits, as witnesses to what God is doing in history. There aren't special individuals that have gifts while others are without them. It is the case that all individuals in the believing community have gifts for the sake of the church. And so the church has got to be a community if it's going to be a royal priesthood. It has to be a community which recognizes and encourages and supports and discerns the gifts present in that community. It offers individuals the opportunity for use and expression of those gifts. Yoder's suggestion then is that what this means, in effect, is that there's no professional religionist, is the way he puts it, that all are co-equal religionists. The fifth characteristic, which takes us back to your earlier opening concern, is a mark of the church is its nature as a place of open meeting, a place in which priority is given not to some individual recognized by a church body, but priority is given to a type of activity in the church, that type of activity being the activity he describes as prophecy. Prophecy meaning improving, consoling, encouraging speech offered on behalf of the community. So what's important in these open meetings is that prophecy take place. But what's not important, the other suggests, is that prophecy be placed in the hands of any particular individual. Instead, that's the work of the community as a whole. God's will is known, Yoder suggests, not in the voice of a specially appointed religionist. The God's will is known not, Yoder suggests, in a vote in which majority is claims the day, that whatever the majority vote is, that's the way you move forward on things. But it's rather the case that what should happen as the church prophesies, as the church deliberates, that in an open meeting in which any and everyone can speak, even the weakest, the poorest in the community, that consensus eventually be achieved. Everyone is given a chance, an opportunity to the floor. And in that prayerful hearing and speaking, eventually the church is moved to some consensus on matters.
Question.
Okay.
I mean, I'm just looking at those top things, and I'm thinking of, well, let's say a Reformed Jewish congregation, and meets most of those criteria, except for baptism, but, I mean, baptism is just sort of the rite of entry. You know, you are now signing a membership book, and you will be a full-fledged member of the congregation at this time. Mm-hmm. So, does his, with his definition?
Well, I mean, that's
a good, broadly.
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's a helpful way of drawing something to our attention, and that is that Yoder's understanding of the church is that it is in fact a continuation of the activity that God began with the Israelites. So there's a sense in which we shouldn't find it too surprising at all if we see one continuation of God's work correlating in significant ways with another continuation of God's work. But I think what Yoder's response would be to say, well, there is some correlation there, but let's don't be too hasty. This, specifically, the binding and loosing that's talked about in Matthew is a binding and loosing which is connected with the identity of Jesus as such. And insofar as all of these activities of the church must point to, as far as Yoder is concerned, must point to the God who was incarnate, who died, who was raised again from the dead, then insofar as that community isn't pointing to that Lord of history, then it's not the same thing, however similar, whatever correlation there may be between the two communities.
Okay, that would be his answer.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, again, Yoder's starting point and his ending point is we don't start from nowhere. You start as part of a tradition. And the tradition he understands himself a part of is the tradition that owns these scriptures. And the story that he and that tradition read in these scriptures is a specific story of God and God being related in a special way, that God coming to history in Christ in a way that, it's a radical particularity but that has to be known.
He would acknowledge other paths, would he?
Yoder's confession, which he thinks is the Christian confession, is that Christ is Lord. Now, your question then has to be rephrased in such a way.
Christ is exclusive Lord.
Well, by definition, I mean, I think it is an exclusivity. I mean, to say that Christ is Lord is to say God has done something in history through this person that God has not done through any other person, that God has accomplished something in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus that could be accomplished, that is accomplished in no other way. This has happened. It's past. It's done. And it's a matter of either recognizing that or not recognizing that. So just as a matter of pure truth and reality, the truth, Christ is Lord, Yoder says, that's the truth of things. And you either recognize that truth and testify and witness to it with your life and activities as a body of people, or you don't.
But his list of five things, though, is a great list for religious communities.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Yoder actually says, not just for religious communities. He thinks that what can happen is that these are that there are truths, because they capture what's true to the nature of things. This is wisdom that can be gleaned and drawn upon by those outside the church. So he thinks, as a matter of fact, what you learn with this mark of the church is a community of binding and loosing, that forgiveness ought to be operative and would be helpfully operative in a civil community outside the church, even if that civil community doesn't recognize Jesus. Nevertheless, the truth of the matter is that being a forgiving community is the way of reality, is the way of the world. And so, in each case, these marks have relevance not just for the church, but what the church should do, and what wise people will do, will be to try to tease out what this could mean for the wider community. So there's a wisdom. The fifth mark, for instance, is upon democracy. I mean, democracy is a good thing, and that's captured there. Yeah.
But what I see is an apology for an Anabaptist church. You know, that it's a very well put together thing that says this is what it means to be a church, but it's really an Anabaptist church that has nothing to do with other denominations unless we convert to them, basically.
Yeah.
And so what's the purpose of this? You know, what can we get out of this that unless we convert to an Anabaptist position, you know, what else is there?
Yeah. Okay, good question. One quick response to you is, I think Yoder would say, well, look, if you think the Mennonite, either of the conventions or branches, any of the conventions, branches of the Mennonite Church do a very good job measuring up to this, then it would be nice if they did. But this is as judgmental upon the Mennonite tradition as it is upon other traditions. So this is a word he's speaking not just to those outside the Anabaptist tradition, but to Mennonites and other Anabaptists who are too acculturated as is.
It's an idealized Mennonite church.
Yeah. Okay, but having said that, one way we could do is we could, your question would be, well, all right, what are we supposed to do with this? What can we, given who we are and where we are, what can we do with this? Well, why don't we, Yoder taught this material here at Holden Village, so he must have thought it would be helpful for whoever his audience would be. Those would have been people like us. So what about that? To what extent can we be who we are, where we are, whether we're Presbyterian, Lutheran, Anglican, whatever, to what extent is it possible to should we identify some of these, as Yoder has, as marks of the church? And if so, to what extent can we make these real and practice them in our congregations, in our churches? Or isn't the case that, no, it's the nature of our churches that we don't have the social structures in which this could be practiced, and so what we really have to say is we're in different worlds. John,
would this be an example? We are part of a very large Presbyterian congregation, but we have a very large focus on small groups. So you can get more into the binding and loosening because you're in a covenant group with a group of people where you study God's word and what's right and wrong for yourselves and for communities and those sorts of things, and you develop a relationship where you can talk about your weaknesses and improvement. So, I mean, is that kind of a way that you talk about where you can personalize that?
Okay, one significant thing about that, I think, is you raise the question of, well, how large a group, how small a group is required for this to be possible. And I think you're quite right. It's hard for me to imagine how you're going to get much in the way of binding and loosing in any real sense in a very large community. I mean, just take the whole issue of I suspect we're all from communions in which there's not a lot of church discipline that takes place in what used to be known as church discipline, precisely because we're in communities in which there's more than one church. And if my local congregation decided we really need to do some, try to restore this person to the congregation by some disciplinary activity, well, the person very easily could, probably already has, joined the church just down the street. Yoder's response is, well, so much the worse for the church. Those churches should be talking together, regardless of their denominational identities. If their Lord professed to be the church, they ought to be talking together so that jumping membership in one congregation isn't a way of avoiding the forgiveness that's necessary to restore a person to right fellowship.
The only thing, if you have one bad apple in a group of a whole bushel of apples, especially the bigger the apples, sometimes problems can relate and can really just totally dismantle the group, or they all go their separate directions.
Well, Yoder, I think Yoder would say, well, look at, I mean, that's an interesting and helpful analogy, but, and it probably works with all sorts of social organizations, but your assumption in using that analogy is that the church is just another social organization. And his response is, the church is its own distinct sociological category. And so you can't import that sort of analogy into the concern.
So, yeah, along the lines suggested, if a group, a secular group, whatever group, were able to accomplish in spirit, in some form, very well each of these five things, with perhaps baptism being problematic, you'd have to replace that with some other ritual. Mm-hmm. If they were able to accomplish that very well without a theological interpretation, mm-hmm. what would Yoder say to that?
Yeah.
And doesn't that happen?
I bet he'd say the same thing you'd say. What would you say to that?
I'm not sure. I wouldn't know what to say.
You'd say, great! That's a good thing that's happening.
But that calls into question whether or not these are marks of the church.
Well, I think Yoder would say, no, I don't think so. He says, look, what we got to remember is there's a deep truth to reality. And the deep truth underneath all of this is that God has accomplished in the suffering servant that shalom, that fulfillment, that justice and peace uniting, that is the story of human history. That's the deep truth, he says. And that God's way of accomplishing that is through the suffering servanthood of Jesus. Now, nothing's going to change that. The only question then, God having accomplished that in the resurrection of Jesus, the only question then is whether for the duration of human history as we know it, folks are going to understand that, grasp that, model their lives in sync and in accordance with that, or whether they will adhere to rebellious powers and not acknowledge that truth. Now, Yoder says, the calling of the church is to be the community that confesses that truth and points to it in their words and in their deeds. That's what the church has got to be. Now, if other institutions, by imitating or engaging in practices that correlate to that deep truth of reality, if they do that, that's great, that's wonderful. We shouldn't be surprised to expect God working in history in such a way that others outside the church do that too. But that's, the church is to affirm that, but that's not the church's calling as such. The church is to be a community like that. And if there are other semblances or approximations of that elsewhere, that's to be affirmed. So I think Yoder's response would be to say, well, any social organization that practices as much of these as possible is better off than one that doesn't. Why? Because these fit with that deeper truth of reality that the way of God is the way of suffering servanthood, and that these practices are practices which embody that deep truth of reality, which is the truth of the suffering servant.
It sounds like that would allow for the possibility that there is a secular group that would more approximate this church ideal than many churches.
Again, your intuitions are probably the same as mine on that, which is, I mean, it's a sad story, but I guess I wouldn't be surprised if that were the case. In fact, I could probably identify some secular groups I belong to, who in certain respects are more churchly than churches I belong to.
But isn't he really saying that there are really six marks? There's one big one, and then there's five little ones.
What assumption?
Your assumption is a mark more so than any of these five, that Christ is Lord.
Yeah.
Isn't it baptism? That's what you're admitting to. I mean, that's part of baptism.
Well, yeah, he talks about it as just entering into the church. Well, what is the church?
Yeah. Well, I think that's right. That all of these are related to that confession and that understanding of what this body of people is to be.
That the gospel is preached and believed.
Yeah.
You know, a church is number one, and the other five are organizational structures.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. One thing that I had, and I think I'm just in the Catholic Church. I've always been Catholic, but it's interesting. Sometimes I think it's interesting because, in the Catholic Church, we had a small Bible study that was solely Catholic. And when we get somebody, one time we had somebody in there, about 20 people, who was just different and had slightly different opinions from what the Catholic Church wanted people to know. They chose instead to kick the one whose opinions just didn't conform to the others in the group, decided to go ahead and encourage them to move elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And I thought, in some cases, that's how they do it, but I think the Catholic Church also is not exactly, they're open to anyone, but if you don't fit, after a small amount of time, they'll go ahead and say, no, we don't think you belong here. And in some ways, like I see number five says, an open meeting, but I think in some cases there has to be some limitations in that concept too.
Yeah. Well, I think that raises the question for us, and the other question would go back to this. Well, this does, it's a nice ideal, but in what sense could it be real in my congregation?
Leadership seems to be a big problem here. I don't know where does leadership, or does Yoder include leadership in the model?
Well, it's open meeting, so, I mean, basically leadership is a matter of the spirits inspiring some people to speak. And inspiring people to work for consensus in a setting in which all are able to speak.
So even though it's a nice idea, but we know we can't ever achieve it, does that mean that we don't work toward it, though?
Well, that's a good question.
When I got ordained, they said also to be a model of the Christly life, and I'm here to tell you, it doesn't happen, on a regular basis, but it doesn't mean I don't work for it, or don't try to strive in that direction.
And it's good to have you affirming even if it's an ideal that we can only remotely approximate to affirm that. But I reflect upon recent congregational meetings in my church.
Oh, I know.
Mine too. Can't we establish small communities within our churches that function this way?
Okay.
Seems to me most change happens by example rather than by convincing people of something. Mm-hmm. And so if we were. The problem is how to convince enough people to form a group.
Mm-hmm. Do you not find the binding and loosing business threatening?
Mm-hmm. It's hard to get people even to sign on to trying it, mm-hmm. I find. You know, I mean, if we all sort of agree we're going to at least try and live by these standards, you know, then that kind of helps us all be accountable to one another. But people, especially on the binding and loosing thing, aren't willing to even sign on for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The other sort of thing I think, is, I mean, think about the sorts of lives we lead and what sort of time commitment it would take mm-hmm. to be this sort of community.
It would take an intense time commitment, and I find it, I found it very difficult to get people who commit to it.
But, well, the binding loosing idea is awful scary, but number two is, in what realistic sense is it even necessary, or do you even think in terms of economic interdependence? There's, you don't go to church and find people that are economically interdependent, you know, dependent upon you and you on them, and it's just doesn't happen, does it?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, isn't the case that you're talking about something that could happen only in a pretty close community where people don't move away?
Hold it.
Well, yeah, but only if you commit yourself to a couple of years. But in our sort of lifestyle, which we move in and out of communities, would you?
We have supervisions and grandkids in our community that we can.
Okay, so we can get a sort of tithing that takes place and ought to take place.
Well, that's a mission sort of an idea, isn't it?
Yeah, that's not the same as redistributing wealth. A soup kitchen.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, I realize from a small standpoint, these at least five aspects may be somewhat cause some variations in all of us, but I think from a grand scale, one of the, especially in terms of open meeting, I'm very, very impressed by Pope John Paul and confronting the Polish country, saying things in the country have to change, and lo and behold, a number of years later, they totally, the whole Eastern Europe, the communism door has been open now. And like you say, even in Cuba, where he's pretty much going to unchurched area and trying to change things, bring the spirit of community. And that's what I think it's great to see what he's doing, but I think he kind of sees that as being an open meeting, saying, hey, we have our differences, but...
We need to sort of draw things to a close. Let me make a couple of announcements, and then if you want to hang around afterwards and carry on and stuff, we can do that. So what announcements did I want to make? On the issue of redistribution and economic issues, Karen will be doing another session this evening at 6:20, yes? So again, an opportunity to think some more about that in that setting. Tonight, in the forum time, if you haven't seen the movie Weapons of the Spirit, it's a story of a community in Le Chambon in France, the story of André Trochnet and his church, which in a very real sense took upon itself the role of royal priesthood and as a community, and precisely because of that and some other fortuitous events and instances, was able to offer refuge and protection in a way that is a model for all of us. So I encourage you to see the film Weapons of the Spirit. If you don't have time or for whatever reason can't see the film Weapons of the Spirit, and when you go back home, there's a wonderful book written by Philip Hallie, Hallie, called Blessed Innocent Blood Be Shed. And that's the same story. It's a powerful tell, and well worth your reading. Tomorrow at 10:30, I think, we turn away from what the church should look like to the church's, what Yoder takes to be the major temptation of the church, Constantinian heresy, as he calls it. And so we'll try to be thinking about what that heresy consists of, what the greatest temptation, what we and the other identify as the great temptations of the church. So thank you very much for your contribution.
And Russell, thank you for the judge of that.